Welcome back to Blue Sierra's Telehealth Radio. I'm Michelle Hegger, the partner, managing partner of Blue Sierra's Consulting. We're based in South Carolina. And tonight I have a great guest from Morgan Lewis, Jake Harper, who's a partner at Morgan Lewis, a law firm that does a lot of work in the telehealth space. We work together in the Center for Telehealth Policy and eLaw. I've known Jake for several years. And in fact, we actually will be in the same place and time next week, advocating on behalf of telehealth in Washington, D.C. So welcome to the show, Jake.
Thank you so much for having me, Michelle. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. I'm happy to have you. I think this is your first time on the show. So thank you for being here. I know we've done a lot of different things together over the years and always love talking to you. But tell us a little bit about Morgan Lewis, the kind of services that you guys provide, and who are your clients typically?
Absolutely. So Morgan Lewis is actually a global law firm. We have offices in all over the world, 2,000 attorneys, and do work for virtually all of the Fortune 100 companies. But our clients range from startups to mid-cap entities to those Fortune 100s, as I mentioned. My particular area and the area of my practice group is largely based in healthcare, representing healthcare clients in a variety of different kinds of matters. So whether it's mergers and acquisitions, whether it's government investigations, we have to deal with DOJ and OIG and state attorney generals, quite often, or just sort of, various questions, right? How do I do this? Am I allowed to do this? Kind of regulatory counseling is another area that we specialize in. And so, it's really great because my practice involves, not just sort of one particular type of provider, but it sort of spans the gamut. And a lot of the work that I do individually is related to telehealth, and whether it's remote patient monitoring, whether it's, arrangements with various telehealth providers or an organization wanting to set up its own telehealth program or get involved in one. That's a lot of the work that I do. So it's really great. Every day is exciting. But then I also coordinate with a lot of my different team members and folks across the country on various kinds of healthcare related issues.
That's great. It's interesting because I think most people may not know that healthcare organizations have to deal with the Department of Justice and need a lot of legal advice. Unfortunately, this is a really regulated industry. And we know, occasionally those cases will come to the news that'll show somebody did, massive Medicare fraud or something along those lines or whatever, but it's not a typical, it's not a typical news story that comes out on a day-to-day basis.
And we hope not. We hope to keep it that way. Unfortunately, it happens from time to time. But I think the, what is it? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So one of the things that we often try to tell our clients is before you get into hot water, think about what you're doing and try to steer clear of the Department of Justice to begin with, and don't sort of get into those areas. And that's a lot of the work that we do.
Absolutely. And now that we're past the PHE, past the public health emergency, we know that so much is changing in the telehealth space. Telehealth is already disruptive to care. It's already a change that's happening in the way that care is delivered. And now we're seeing so much change in the laws related to it, the regulation related to it. Individual states are doing things differently. Obviously, the federal government is giving us guidance. We have some reprieve that we've talked about on this show before, where, some of the flexibilities that we had in the PHE are extending through either the end of this calendar year or the end of next calendar year, mostly to get us kind of level set for what is going to come after 2024 into 2025. But give us your perspective on this from a legal perspective. What do people need to think about post PHE? Where should they focus? What's your advice without being legal advice?
That's right. None of this is legal advice. I think that the what I've heard, the good news is that you know, planes aren't falling out of the sky, right? You know, people aren't getting surgery on the wrong leg, you know, that kind of stuff. So we haven't, you know, after the end of the public health emergency, which I think was, you know, very concerning for the healthcare stakeholders and like what's going to happen here, especially for telehealth, as you mentioned, most of the really relevant things that are useful in the telehealth context are remaining in place. And so that certainly buys everyone time to sort of get a better understanding of what's going on. So whether it's, you know, making sure you have a HIPAA compliant telehealth platform, you know, the Office for Civil Rights has said that they're not going to enforce things until, you know, the middle of the summer. You know, DEA was sort of touch and go for a while there. And they've said that, you know, we're going to keep things in place until November of this year while we sort of consider other issues as well. But, you know, I think this is a time period where the federal government in particular is trying to make a realistic assessment of the efficacy and the value and the quality of telehealth as a general sort of sub-practice area, right? So in 2008, when the last substantive permanent telehealth rules were issued, it was obviously very different, right? We had the internet that existed, but other than that, and you know, some you know, telecommunications technologies, it was fairly limited and it was not accessible to regular individuals, right? That was, I think, around the time when the first iPhone even came out, was probably around then. And when you think about the massive technological change that's happened over the past decade, we live in a very different world, right? So you have the ability to see literally anyone in the world at any moment via video on your phone now. And that didn't exist a decade ago. You have the ability to transmit huge amounts of data across wireless networks seamlessly from any location. And so that is almost a existential change, if you will, for the technology, and the implications for that in the healthcare context are massive. And the fact that we don't have, you know, permanent legislation now really speaks to the idea that, you know, I think particularly in healthcare, a lot of folks have been reticent about whether it is an appropriate mechanism to provide healthcare services. And I think the public health emergency and the COVID-19 pandemic, for, you know, all the horrible things that it caused and the lives lost, the silver linings, I think, are that it really forced us to embrace this particular aspect of technology and how it impacts healthcare services. And that sort of acted as a dress rehearsal, if you will, for the future and sort of healthcare, call it 2.0 at this point. So so I think, you know, the big issues now that the government is facing in deciding how to legislate this permanently going forward are really those cost considerations, right? How is the Congressional Budget Office going to score telehealth, particularly in the Medicare program, you know, from whether it's a cost driver or a cost saver? It's still a little unclear, but I know a lot of organizations, including CTEL, are working to identify and provide data that would support that it is a cost saver at the end of the day, to give CBO essentially more cover that you know, they could score it in that certain way. The other big issue I think that we're still reeling from and trying to work through are program integrity concerns, right? You know, when you have, you know, fraud and abuse kinds of issues that are localized to, let's say, this hospital or this medical clinic or things like that, right? They're limited in scope, right? You can kind of figure out where they are. But when you have a telehealth program, and we've seen this, unfortunately, there are bad actors over the course of the past 2 years, they're able to scale that so much more significantly. And the scalability of telehealth, I think in that interaction with program integrity, is a really critical thing that you know, federal government and state governments are really thinking about, and I think are struggling with at this point. So they're trying to build in safeguards. They're trying to educate, in particular, the provider community, the physician community, to understand sort of what our appropriate use is and what may not be appropriate uses of telehealth. But I think once we get through those sort of big macro level issues, everything else will fall into place. So I do anticipate that there will be some legislation, you know, over the course of the next year, maybe year and a half. I'm hoping it doesn't get to December 2024.
Yeah.
Get that. But I, you know, I think that there's going to be a permanent fix built in for telehealth in the Medicare program going forward.
Yeah. I've always said that I thought it would really flow in with the physician fee schedule, that they kind of, it seems to me like they want that to be the schedule for where the notifications happen for telehealth, because a lot of it is around whether or not, you know, what the payment process is going to be. And I think that drives usage. It's interesting. You're right. Technology wasn't around back in 2008. And we learned so much during the pandemic around the fragility of our broadband capability across the country. So we now know that we need to work on that. And part of the infrastructure of the country, it needs to include essentially what I would consider to be a utility in the internet services that are existing across the country, which help people get access to healthcare and education, kids and education that we saw very brightly during the pandemic.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So just on that point, you know, I think the other two sort of smaller issues that we're going to have to deal with are exactly relating to those issues. So, particularly folks in rural areas where that broadband connection is not great, they've had to rely on phones and basically what we call audio only telehealth services. And that's a really big sticking point, I think, for federal regulators, because I think they view that for whatever reason as not being as effective and not really being the kind of virtual encounter that they were anticipating and wanted to promote in sort of the larger scale. So I think the whether audio only as a mechanism for telehealth services, a modality, is going to be a battleground kind of issue. The other one that we're going to have to deal with as well is whether this is going to be permissible for new patients or just established patients. And I think there's some debate, right? Some folks can see why you'd want to have an in-person visit. Others are sort of on the line of, well, listen, we need accessibility more than anything else. We're in a crisis in terms of healthcare shortage for professionals, and you know, access is becoming more and more of a problem. Maybe having this sort of additional barrier to entry is not a good idea. So I think those are two issues that we're going to have to flesh out over the next year.
Yeah, and by service, I mean, maybe behavioral health is different than primary care. You know, you just, we don't know how that's, like you said, how that's going to flesh out. You touched on DEA laws. We did have that challenge around the DEA there at the beginning of the year, thankfully, or even just a month ago. Why does it feel so long ago? we were sort of living on this cliff of what was going to happen with, with the DEA laws, but we still have these challenges, not only with how are we going to, that's only just a reprieve for, like we said, just a certain length of time. And then we also have the challenges around provider licensure that our earlier guests we talked about, and some of the challenges that Linda Brannigan and UCSF run into when they're trying to care for patients across state lines because they've come to them for specialty care and then going home to recuperate and to recover. And then now we're not going to have all these specialty hospitals have to, you know, license across the country. So there's two issues there. There's the DEA, you know, prescribing question in the beginning, and then provider licensure and the challenges around that. What does your crystal ball say? What are your thoughts around that? And why is this such a challenge?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, taking the DEA first, I think one of the important things to think about is that the DEA has a different objective. They have a different perspective, right? Their goal is to make sure that these list of controlled substances don't get into hands of people that are not allowed to have those, right? And so they don't necessarily care, or at least it's not their primary objective, to focus on access, to focus on patient rights, or, you know, making sure that physicians can be able to prescribe certain medications. So they have a totally different tact and a different purpose. And I think that's important to keep in mind when we're thinking about sort of DEA policymaking and interactions with the DEA. That said, they have a very important job, right? And we can't just say, oh, well, you know, telehealth is important and healthcare is important, right? We know that there are situations where you know, controlled substances are dispensed as a result of, you know, improper telehealth encounters. And that's where the Ryan Haidt Act came from back in 2008 as well, which, you know, also was controlling these issues at this point. So I think that I am appreciative of the fact that the DEA, I think, saw how many public comments it received as part of its proposed rulemaking on sort of the future of teleprescribing. And I think that the amount of comments it received really drove it to say, oh, we need to sort of pump the brakes and let's rethink things. And so they issued that temporary rule last month, as you were mentioning, to say, hey, we're gonna keep everything in place for the next 6 months and have this sort of, you know, grandfathered approach for folks in this interim period. But I do think that they are giving a legitimate legitimate thoughts to all of these comments and what they're ultimately going to do. And so, you know, it's hard to say exactly whether they will maintain this process that they've proposed that would essentially require in-person visits for most services, at least after a certain time period. That's very limiting. It certainly is very limiting, and that would impact a number of different types of providers from being able to teleprescribe, particularly with patients, as you mentioned, Michelle, in those instances where they're not, you know, geographically very close. So, you know, I do think that they will hear those public comments and alter their approach, but I don't know how much and whether they will get away from that requirement that says we think it's important that a physician see a person in person, a patient in person, to make sure that they are who they say they are and that they need exactly what they're saying that they need.
Yeah, and so, interject there on the, I know you've said this before, and I think it's the right way to look at it. The DEA is an enforcement agency. They're not a healthcare agency, right? Yeah. So as you said, they're looking at how do we keep those drugs out of the hands of the wrong people in the wrong time. And so their perspective is different, but yeah, 38,000 comments, that does tend to change your mind a little bit.
That's not a lot. It was really, I think, really incredible. You know, you can tell that the outpouring from the healthcare community about that rule was pretty significant, right? That's not just telehealth providers, right? That's health systems and a variety of other provider types that are commenting on that rule. So it just highlights the importance of this particular issue.
And patience.
Yeah.
And the provider licensure thoughts, when you think about this cross-state licensure issue, it's a challenge for telehealth. It's an expense associated with this for physicians, and it's a barrier.
It certainly is. And I think it's, my hope is that it's a matter of time, right? We've seen these fantastic results from the Interstate Nurse Licensing Compact. There's other compacts that are being developed that, you know, look, I don't think we're going to get away from the concept that because states aren't going to give up this power. They are the licensors and they are the ones that decide who gets to provide these kinds of services in their particular states. I don't think those medical boards and nursing boards and other boards are going to give up that authority at some point. So what I think is sort of the best middle ground for that is really that compact approach, right? And unfortunately, the way that the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact is set up at this point, it simply is not, it doesn't have any efficacy, right, at all. It's a fast track to get a different license, but most folks don't want that. They don't need that. And it's helpful, but it really doesn't solve the main problem of the cost and the time associated with getting all of these different licenses. When you look at, you know, just how I would say global, you know, healthcare is now, it's not like there's a community physician from Idaho and one from Florida who are doing significantly different things, right? And so when we had sort of the concept of licensure back in the day, it was like, well, you know, in Idaho, our community standard of care might be X, whereas California or New York or Florida, our community standard of care is different. I think there's more of a general expectation across the board that all doctors, all licensed people are going to be more or less providing the same standard of care. Well, you know, in a defense standpoint, we might sort of argue the opposite, but I think for the most part, that is the way that things are shaking out now, with just, again, how much interconnectivity everyone has. So the Nurse Licensure Compact has been really effective. You know, nurses in a member state basically say, I'm licensed in, you know,
Arizona.
So here, I'm in Virginia, and here's my license, and it still works, just like the driver's license, right? And I think, you know, to me, it's incumbent on the Federation of State Medical Boards, which is sort of the organizing entity for all. It's sort of the trade group, if you will, for state medical boards. It's really incumbent on them to redesign the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact and make it work. And they need to do that. And particularly if telehealth is going to be a permanent presence in sort of the way that healthcare is provided, I think that's something that's just going to necessarily be required to sort of take some of the costs out and take some of the administrative burden out of it. And look, it doesn't really, you know, having 50 licenses doesn't really help anyone, right? Maybe the medical boards make some more money from it, but I mean, it's a pretty small, I think, amount overall. And so I think a model approach on the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact is going to be important.
And could they do something like pharmacy, right? Where there's the pharmacy licensure is the same thing, where there's some reciprocity across some states, and then those pharmacists only need to take just the law of that particular state, right? They only need to have some evaluation of their understanding of the law when they're getting licensed in that state. That could be, you know, a middle ground if it's not completely changed in the way that the nursing licensure compact is.
Yeah. And look, I think you're right. There's a couple of other ways that this could be done, mm-hmm. right? Some states have licensure laws that exclude borders, right? So if you may be licensed in a different state and you kind of have this border, you know, whether it's 5 miles or 10 miles or 100 miles, right? On the state, but that seems to be a good effective way to do it. And I think as UCSF may have hopefully considered this as well, right? Some states allow for follow-on care as well, right? So you have sort of essentially almost like a global surgical period, right? So you have 90 days post care in order to see patients, and it doesn't really matter where the license. The problem with that is you have to have that state, right? So if you're going to, let's say, UCSF, if you get treated in California but you live in Minnesota, the relevant law at that point is Minnesota's, not California's, right?
Exactly.
And you have all these states on board, which is really complex. I will say the one good thing that I've seen so far with this, and you know, again, we've been in a sort of a public health emergency standpoint, so I don't know how stock we can put into it, but the fact is there's been not a whole lot of enforcement activity when it comes to one-off licensure issues, right? Where I'm treating a patient typically in Virginia, and then I have one patient that I see in, you know, Tennessee for one particular reason or another.
Yeah.
I'm not licensed in Tennessee. We haven't seen a lot of enforcement in that area.
Yeah. Right?
Until you get an event when someone gets hurt, someone gets injured, and there's a malpractice claim. In that case, then all bets are off and it's a huge problem. But there hasn't been a sort of a steady stream of enforcement when it comes to cross state licensure issues.
Yeah. And I think that it's a difficult landscape for clinicians to navigate, and which makes it less appealing for them to do if they have, you know, these challenges like, well, I'm not really sure how the payment's going to work. I'm not really sure how the licensure is going to work. I'm not really sure what the enforcement is going to go on. And now that we're post PHE, we've seen the OIG and HHS what I call the shot off the bow. They sent a toolkit out that said, hey, here's how you can check your claims to make sure that your claims were correct during the PHE, which of course is to me the precursor to they're starting their auditing of
wink, nudge, nudge.
Exactly. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Start looking at your claims to make sure you did them correctly. And all of us that have ever been in healthcare and worked in hospitals before, you know, the scariest words you ever want to hear is take back, right? So you don't want any take back money. And the government will get their money one way or the other. So this idea of, you know, now we're going to start to see these audits happening. What's your perspective on that? What should folks think about? And what's your advice without being legal advice?
Yeah, no, I think it's important just to keep this perspective in mind that, you know, irrespective of what kind of emergency situation we've been in, federal enforcement agencies tend to be a little short-sighted or forgetful, maybe. So, you know, I remember this after Katrina or after Superstorm Sandy, right? Where the message at the time is do what you can, right? Take care of patients. This is an emergency situation. Do what you can, sort of all bets are off. We're going to work with you. We're going to be partners to make sure that we can care for people who are in dire need of healthcare and other services. And I think, you know, that's certainly, you know, appropriate and you know, is I think in those emergency situations how things should be run. But what I've seen is that after the fact, when the dust settles, enforcement agencies tend to not give as much credit to the fact that there was an emergency going on when they're doing these things like audits and investigations and other inquiries. So it's really important, I think, that providers, while you had flexibility at some point to you know, not have to meet this requirement or that requirement, it's not sort of carte blanche to say, well, it was an emergency and so I didn't meet all of these other things that weren't waived, right? So the requirements that weren't subject to a waiver or some other kind of flexibility, to the extent that, you know, a healthcare organization didn't meet those requirements, I think they can't anticipate that the federal government is not going to say, or a state government or other kind of auditor is not going to say, oh, well, it's okay, it was the PHE, right? I mean, they kind of had their list of things that they flexed on, that they waived, and the things that they didn't, they felt were necessary and remain necessary in order to be providing these kinds of healthcare services and getting paid for them. So I think it's really important that you know, self-auditing be done, prepare for audits of this time period. The OIG is certainly going to be looking at it from a telehealth, fraudsters who took advantage of the situation. And not just in telehealth, but in a bunch of different areas, lab services, PPE, vaccines, you name it. There's people that every industry is always going to have a certain level of fraud. Unfortunately, it's just the nature of our interactions in a society. But I do think that, you know, the OIG and other organizations are going to be looking at providers to see whether there is some kind of fraud or even just, you know, waste and abuse, right? Which are sort of the other categories that we think about here. It's not, we don't necessarily need an intentional act, but if there's sort of significant, you know, you guys knew what the rules were and you ignored them, or you didn't, you should have boned up on them and you didn't, there's going to be takebacks for that, unfortunately. And so, you know, I would anticipate that in the next year, there's going to be a flurry of activity from enforcement agencies covering telehealth providers in particular.
I agree. And I think folks need to pay attention to that. Don't ignore that. Don't put your head in the sand. If you do need regulatory advice, you do need compliance advice, obviously Morgan Lewis, Jake Harper, definitely available to you. We also at Luceris give you some advice on how to put together your policies and to audit your claims and how to make that all work and be prepared for these incoming audits that are inevitable, really, in this world these days. But Jake, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being on the show. This was a great discussion, and we're going to have you back because it's always interesting to hear your perspective and get your take on things.
My pleasure, Michelle. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So at Blue Sierras Radio, we always try to give our listeners helpful information on healthcare and telehealth. We hope you have a great rest of the week. And thanks again, Jake, for educating us on healthcare, telehealth, provider licensure, PHE, and OIG. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show. We'll be right back. And thanks for listening to Blue Sierras Radio. We are the smartest show on radio.